You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Wednesday, July 10th, 2013. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, updating us on the pain the sequester is causing, contrary to what they're telling you in the mainstream media, Sam Stein from the Huffington Post. Also on the program today, fighting back. Great clip of a woman in Texas speaking truth to power to the Texas state legislature. Also some students talking back to the NSA at a recruitment meeting. Meanwhile, we'll get to that story of Bin Laden's car stop in Pakistan and some breaking news on how to pronounce comptroller. Meanwhile, Governor Vaginal Probe ensnared in a criminal probe. All that and more on today's program. We're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back with Sam Stein. We are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome back to the program from the Huffington Post, Sam Stein, not to be confused with Sam Cedar. Welcome to the program, Sam.
Oh, thanks for having me.
I can't tell you how often I get, oh, my God, it's a real pleasure to meet you. You're Sam Stein.
And I get it just the opposite. They always think I'm funnier because they assume I'm Sam Cedar.
You don't really. Do you get that?
No, it's never happened.
It's bizarre to me. Like, literally, my downstairs neighbor was like, have I ever seen you on TV? Yeah, maybe on MSNBC. You're Sam Stein. No, I'm not. But it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. So that's fine. I appreciate getting the credit for a lot of the work you're doing.
I was going to say, I want rights.
Keep up the good work, because it really does, it really does help me. All right, now I appreciate you're taking the time, Sam. I know that you're stuck now in a in some type of elevator shaft somewhere in the bowels of the Huffington Post. But I want to talk about the work you've been doing, and particularly this latest piece. But the work that you have been doing in tracking the implications of the sequester, which is long gone now from the front pages and the cable talk shows, because I think there's a sense out there that the sequester was sort of the the mouse that didn't, or the lion that didn't roar. There's some type of metaphor there, but in fact, sure. This is causing real pain across the country as we speak.
Yeah, well, I think the metaphor is the dog that didn't bark or bite. And yeah, you're
there's
right.
A mountain.
There's conventional wisdom taking hold right now in D.C. that says sequestration was this oversold bag of, you know, cuts, and that they actually haven't really impacted anybody. And there's a really different story if you talk to anyone on the receiving end of the cuts, predominantly outside D.C., but a lot of people in D.C. too. And, you know, their lives have been completely upended by this. And so what we've tried to do is just sort of trace the impacts of policy decisions in Washington to where they matter the most. And, you know, we've done it with a number of things. The most recent one was looking at what's happening with parents and families who have kids in the Head Start program and what it means for them. And, you know, across the country, kids are being denied access to Head Start when they previously had it. And that means that parents are being forced to figure out, you know, how they're going to take care of the kids during the day, whether they're going to have to spring for daycare. In some cases, how they're going to spring for the two hot meals a day that their kids are getting at the Head Start program. And for low-income families, you know, that's it's not easy. It's, you know, it could be somewhere between, you know, $500 to $700 a month that you have to take out of your pocket for daycare that you previously didn't have. And so, you know, there are real-world implications to sequestration, and not a lot of people understand them or are exploring them.
And specifically when we talk about Head Start, I mean, this is a statistic that I cite quite often on this program, but a child of a low-income family enters into kindergarten with a listening vocabulary of 20,000 less words than that of a child of upper income. 20,000 less words. And Head Start is at least mitigates that to some degree, where you're giving
yeah.
kids a chance to enter into school on an equal footing, or at least a relatively equal footing. And so the implications here are not just in terms of what it does to the lives of these families at the time, but you're also handicapping children significantly as they go through their school years.
That's absolutely right. I mean, one of the underlying goal of Head Start is essentially to put disadvantaged kids on as much of an even footing as they can entering kindergarten. I mean, that's the idea behind Head Start. Use federal resources to get these kids the sort of advantages that middle-income, upper-income kids have, and it has long-term help and ramifications for these children and the families. And so whether it's reading comprehension or writing skills, those are very important. But, you know, Head Start goes so far beyond educational services, too. In Vermont, this is part of the story, in Vermont they have what they call a tooth tutor program, which is basically trying to teach kids and the families about dental hygiene. And I interviewed a mother whose older child hadn't gone through the Vermont Head Start and had all types of tooth problems when she was young. And they cost the family, you know, a lot. And they cost the kid a lot of pain, obviously, because who likes going to the dentist repeatedly? Her younger daughter was put through the Head Start program, did the tooth tutor program. She's been perfectly fine. She has great dental hygiene. And, you know, it might seem like a small thing in the grand scheme of things, but having that type of, you know, professional guidance with respect to dentistry is something that low-income families just never even contemplate or think about because they have so many other things on their ledger. That's what Head Start provides to these kids. And, you know, it just gives them a decent shot or a better shot at succeeding later in life because these are formative years for them.
And so do we have a sense, I mean, is it possible, I mean, you know, one of the things that obviously you guys are doing over there at the Huffington Post, and I should say that there's a number that you have where people can call in with their stories about dealing
yeah.
with different aspects of the sequester. The number is 860-348-3376. There's an email address, too. We'll put both those on the blog at majority.fm. But is there any way to get, I mean, a definitive number of what the implications are? Because this is, I mean, one of the things that I've noticed about the sequester is anything that was sort of a national, had national implications or at least affected people who had access to the national media or to Washington. And I'm thinking specifically about the FAA cuts, but I
yeah.
know there are others, got the attention. But the stuff that is sort of localized, it's just not getting it's just not becoming a national narrative.
Well, sure. I mean, a lot of people in my profession and a lot of people who work for Congress don't have their kids in Head Start, and that's one of the reasons why not that much attention has been on it. But I think there's sort of a more pernicious explanation for what's going on here, which is that a lot of these cuts are happening in the abstract. It's what won't get done. So, you know, Head Start, for example, has shifted a lot of the cuts that they're going to make to the incoming class of students. So next year, local Head Start might, for instance, offer 100 fewer slots. That's not affecting anyone right now except for the teachers who get fired. But it is affecting the future generation of parents. And the economic ramifications of sequestration are going to be felt down the road as well. So yesterday, Amanda Turkle and I, my colleague Amanda Turkle and I, did a protest jog with we were reporting on a protest jog of Department of Defense civilian employees who were beginning their furlough days, and we talked to a bunch of them about what they were going to do, how they're going to change their lifestyle habits because they're getting furloughed now 11 days until the end of September. And one of the guys said to me, he goes, well, you know, I called up Comcast on my first furlough day because I wanted to get my Comcast bill reduced. And so I thought about it. I said, well, there's 650 Department of Defense civilian employees who are going to get furloughed. If 10% of them did the same thing, just called up Comcast to figure out how to reduce their bill, and if on average they reduced their bill by $20, what would that mean? And that's a $1.3 million hit for a company like Comcast. Now, that might be nothing for Comcast, but the economic ripple effects of it do go a long way. And so that's the thing about sequestration. Part of the reason there isn't this political pressure to get it done or repealed or replaced is because so much of it is just going to snowball. And eventually, down the road, we're going to have we're going to realize what we want. But right now, I don't think there's a lot of political pressure to change course.
We've talked about Head Start. There are other programs that have really been hit by this. Meals on Wheels comes to mind as well. Tell us what you know about that and other areas that we haven't heard much about in terms of where people are feeling the pain.
Okay, so the main places right now that are feeling the pain are the social safety net programs like Head Start, Meals on Wheels, which is facing cuts across the city, which means essentially fewer hot meals delivered to needy seniors across the country. Public defenders' offices across the country are getting cut. And, you know, what they're doing essentially is they're taking away not the lawyers who staff the public defender's office, but everything around them. So I talked to a bunch of lawyers in public defender's office who are basically handling cases without investigators. And anyone who's been in the law understands that you need an investigation to figure out how to argue your case. So they're basically hampered and hamstrung in that respect. Medical research is taking a huge hit. The National Institute of Health has really cut back on the grants that it's handing to, you know, universities and scientists. And so what we're going to end up seeing is a number of possible advancements in medical technology or science technology are just not going to happen. And I talked to a researcher team out at Temple University who was going to test three strands of some sort of medicine that they were developing. Now they're only going to test two. So you can imagine what's going to happen in that case. And then there's finally the most public thing that's happened that hasn't been fixed yet is Medicare reimbursement to private cancer clinics is being up. So basically, private cancer clinics get reimbursed for the cost of administering Medicare cancer drugs, and they get an administrative reimbursement as well. Those reimbursements are going to be cut. It means basically that fewer patients are going to get cancer treatment when they need it. They're going to have to be deferred to public hospitals. Some of them might have to travel hundreds, if not thousands of miles to get the treatment they need. It's being felt in various different forms across the country, and the only places where we fixed it is with air traffic controllers, so that there's less flight delays, and with meat inspection. We've maneuvered around the furloughs for meat inspectors.
Now, there's two aspects to this. One is it's a sort of a classic case of the lack of political punch that basically the poor and lower income people have in this country, and also it seems to me a failure by those who are against the sequestration. I mean, I guess presumably the Democrats on some level, I mean, and the administration to hold the line on things like the meat inspection and the FAA so that this you know, we could have the so-called shared sacrifice that we hear so
yeah.
much about.
Well, the whole idea behind it was shared sacrifice, right? The bet was that Republicans would find the Department of Defense cuts repugnant. Democrats would find the social safety net cuts repugnant, and therefore they'd have to come to an agreement to replace the thing. But that, of course, didn't work out, in part because, you know, Republicans didn't want to have tax hikes in it, and Democrats did. And so now, you know, the replacement conversation has turned to, well, will there be enough struggling, enough pain being felt across the country that Congress will have to rethink this? And I got to tell you, I mean, if you look at local clips, when members of Congress are back home in their districts, they, you know, commiserate with the people who are suffering. They say, you know, sequestration is a bad thing. We want to replace it. But the national conversation is so far removed. I talked to Congresswoman Rosa DeLauro for this piece on Head Start, and she said, you know, no one's talking about replacing sequestration anymore. It's just not even on our radar. And the people who have the power to, you know, change these cuts that are happening aren't, you know, paying attention. And so I think unless there's some sort of miracle grand bargain deal that happens in the next couple months, and there is a push point for that, which is this debt ceiling and budget negotiations. If they can figure out a way to replace sequestration in those, maybe there is a way out. But outside of that small chance, it looks like this is going to be the policy for some period of time.
Right. And the debt ceiling showdown that will take place sometime in the early fall, I think, is certainly not the pressure points don't lead towards refunding these programs, it seems to me.
Well, I mean, if I had to make a guess, it wouldn't necessarily be refunding, although it could. It would just be reshuffling. I mean, some of the cuts will happen regardless to some of these programs. I mean, there's certain programs that even in the Obama administration's own budget, they were cutting stuff like weatherization and, you know, detecting, you know, certain storms and things like that. But, you know, for the more visible programs like a Head Start, yeah, that's the saving grace right there, is can they figure out a way to restore some of the funds. And, you know, I do think you have seen a number of Republicans concerned about the cuts to NIH grants. You have seen some in their districts talking to Head Start parents, commiserating with them. So there isn't, it's not like there's no political appetite here. It's just figuring out how to fit all the pieces together.
Now, I know you got to go in a minute or two, but the sequestration story of 2013 seems to be that it's hard to measure these things because of how localized and the constituency that is hurt by these cuts. When we move into 2014, this is going to radically change, isn't it?
I think so. I mean, you're absolutely right about how, you know, it's so localized, it's hard to measure these cuts. But like I said, also, I think the big story is that, you know, a lot of these agencies have tried as best they can to put off the cuts as long as they can. So, for instance, the Department of Defense didn't start furloughing their employees until Monday. And so, you know, they pushed it everything they could as far back into the fiscal year as possible.
And they did that with the assumption, or at least the hope, that Congress would address this in some fashion.
Exactly. But at some point, you can't push more. And right. That's when, you know, the proverbial shit hits the fan. I think I could say shit on radio. And then, I think then you're going to start hearing a lot more. Whether that's going to be enough is another case. But this is a slow train wreck that's happening in real time, and we've forgotten about it, I think, nationally for a little bit, but it's taking place. It doesn't take much digging to find these stories, and at some point, those stories are going to resurface, and we're going to start wondering, why had we not noticed this
now,
when it was taking place?
And the cuts that kick in 2014 are far more severe, aren't they?
Yes, it builds up over time, but the severity of it is simply because it has a snowball effect. So when you, for instance, defund a research project, or you force a research project to cut back, that affects it in year one, obviously, by cutting it back. But that means in year two that you have to do double the investment to get back to where you were at the original baseline. And you're not even, you're stuck at even reduced funds even then. So just to catch up to where you thought you would be becomes a compounding effect. And so, yeah, and it's
but
in 2014, it's going to hurt even more.
But don't the cuts, I mean, like the EPA cuts, the Department of Labor cuts, aren't they just on paper more severe than they were this year? And part of that also because you're dealing with a full fiscal year as opposed to two-thirds of the fiscal year?
Yes, so we had an $85 million cut in this fiscal year. It's going to be bigger than that, obviously, to get to the $1 billion over 10 years, roughly, for the size of sequestration. Top on that, the fact that everyone's trying to backload these cuts, then yes, it's going to be worse.
Wow, okay. And I mean, at the end of the day, from a political standpoint, last question, the sequestration, if we're to believe guys like, I think it was Jack Lew, said this was sort of baked into the DNA, like, you know, this was a way, a political maneuver to force a grand bargain. Can we say that from a political standpoint, this whole concept of the super committee and then the sequestration as a political concept was a real failure?
Yeah, I don't think there's any other way to judge it. No one wanted this to pass. Everyone agreed to it on the premise that it wouldn't pass, and then it passed. And now everyone's living with the consequences. And it's such a it is a deliberately poorly designed policy. It was supposed to hurt the most vulnerable people in society, and it's doing that. But the fact that Congress couldn't get its act together really says something. And, you know, it's been a total failure.
And right, to be fair, what we have is basically one party in Congress that is fundamentally sort of their agenda seems to be nothing but to gum up the works of government in some fashion. And it was a tremendous underestimation, I think, of that will by the White House and the Democrats. And so now we're living with the consequences.
I think that's right.
Sam Stein, thank you so much for joining us. And I want to make something absolutely clear. Sam Cedar does not use expletives on the radio. Sam Stein, however, apparently does. So
sorry about that.
No problem. We're going to put a link up with that number and that email. If you have stories, folks, send them on to Sam. Thanks so much for the talk, Sam.
All right. Take care, Sam. Take care. Bye-bye.
All right, folks, we're going to take just a – well, you know what? We don't need to take a break here. I'll just go right into this. We will be bringing more on the sequestration. And as I said, go to majority.fm. You can get – you'll find a phone number there and email. If you have stories of how the sequestration is affecting you, please let us know. And you can find that at the bottom of Sam Stein's piece on the sequestration. They've got a link there, too, but we will put all of that on the front page. Just a little bit of housekeeping here, folks. Yesterday on the program, I was discussing the story of Elliot Spitzer running for office again in New York City. And I expressed some confusion as to what the comptroller is, spelled comptroller, versus the controller. And I know what a controller does for a city, but I wasn't quite sure if the comptroller was different. Well, a helpful listener on Twitter, Scrutatrix, probably mispronouncing that too. Well, we'll put a link to her Twitter feed on majority.fm, sent me a link to a piece that she had written 15 years ago regarding this confusion. And it appears that comptroller is essentially controller and is in fact pronounced controller. She writes, despite the archaic spelling, the word is correctly pronounced controller.
I don't know who straight you wrong.
You did. The pronunciation as controller is unquestionably correct and is usually preferred. The comptroller pronunciation is increasingly common and is variously regarded as an error or as an acceptable new pronunciation. Now, this is 15 years ago, so maybe
the ship has sailed then.
Yeah, I mean, maybe it's too late, but you should know the controller, regardless of how you spell it, basically is sort of like the CFO, maybe,
That's what it sounds like to me.
Of the city. I mean, they keep an eye that that there's no cost overruns in certain projects. They also check, according to what Spitzer wants to do, the efficiency of programs. And in some respects, adjudicates also, according to what Spitzer wants to do, adjudicates the validity or efficacy of a policy, and also controls or comptrolls, if you will, the investments. There are pension funds that cities hold, and they invest these pension funds ostensibly to get a return. All right. Moving on. I don't know if by now you have seen this clip. My expectation is you will within the next 24 hours, but you will hear it now. As you know, the bullies in the Texas state legislature are now again attempting to ram through, that's for Michael, provisions to curtail women's right to the constitutionally guaranteed right of abortion options and access to abortion care. And we, by now, most of you know the story of what happened in the first special session that was called, I guess it was now over a week ago, wherein the Democrats filibustered, and then there was almost a people's filibuster for the last 15 minutes. There's been another special session. It has been ongoing. Yesterday, the Senate Republicans in the Texas State Senate ostensibly were to hear comments. And apparently, though, if they hear comments they don't like, they will shut you down. This is a Texas resident, Sarah Slayman, who was testifying, so disgusted by what she saw that she went off script. And apparently then this ends, and you can hear it on some level, certainly see it, with her being dragged out by two Texas state troopers. Sarah will be on this program tomorrow to talk about her experience. And but here is a clip of what she had to say. It's almost 3 minutes long, but it's worth every moment of it. She is addressing a Texas state senator.
Sarah Slayman. Thank you, Chair and Committee. My name is Sarah Slayman. I'm constituent of Senator Whitmire. I'm here to testify against SB1 because I'm tired of Republican primary politics, misogyny, and greed dominating the state I was born, raised, and schooled in. And, you know, I had some really eloquent remarks written out, but you guys have just worn me down all day with all this terrible science and glad-handing. And to be frank, I get to move to New York next month, so I don't have to live in fear of you Texas legislators anymore and what you're going to do to my education system or my healthcare system, because I'm going to a state that doesn't kill its own inmates. That's how pro-life it is up there. I will thank you, though, first. It was destiny that you would discriminate against us and try to force your way inside the bodies of Texas women. Thank you for finally working against us women so publicly and not in the shadows like you're used to. Thank you for every single bad press conference with your bad information. Thank you for every hateful statement degrading women and girls to sex objects and broodmares and bald eagles and leather wallets like your eloquent pro-life supporters have done today. Thank you for being you, Texas legislature. You have radicalized hundreds of thousands of us. And no matter what you do for the next 22 days, women and their allies are coming for you. Let's start down the line. Senator Campbell, you're an ophthalmologist, so I won't be making you the expert on reproductive health. We can give you all the children with chlamydia and herpes in their eyes since we don't have sex ed in this state. And Senator Hagar, you're about as healthful. You are about as... Excuse me. This is my government, ma'am. I will judge you. I will judge you, ma'am. Is this counting against my time?
Yes, it is.
The senator talking against me?
Yes, it is.
Okay. Well, I will just go ahead and talk over her. And this is how big of a fraud I knew you were for being so proud of these proceedings all night. It's a low bar that you hold yourself to that you simply allowed us to speak. And I will speak against an ophthalmologist who says, everyone on the internet can see what you're doing right now. This is a farce. The Texas legislator is a bunch of liars who hate women.
Our next witness is Gary Oldham. Is Gary Oldham here?
Yes, ma'am.
Go ahead. Go ahead, Mr. Oldham.
Thank you. My name is Gary Oldham. I live in...
There you go. And just an incredible amount of bravery, and to see her speak truth to power. She will be on this program on Thursday, talking to us, and it is just really impressive, and can't wait to welcome her to New York. Not as good as it could be, but it certainly sounds like it's a little bit better for women than it is in Texas.
It sounds like we should have like a welcoming committee for her here.
Indeed. I hope she makes her way up to Albany, frankly. Because they could use a good talking to as well.
It's like, quite frankly, we're not passing any abortion bills. We're just defrauding the entire state.
Right.
Would
exactly.
Leave us alone, please.
All right. Second, following this theme of people speaking truth to power. And I don't know how I came across this, but I think it's starting to get out there. There's a woman, Mahida Tahrir. I may be pronouncing that wrong. She's an independent journalist. I think she has a piece in the New Inquiry right now on drones. She apparently is... attending a program at University of Wisconsin, learning a language over the summer. And the NSA sent a couple of recruiters to the language program to ostensibly recruit people to work for the NSA. And there were two recruiters, a woman and a man. Apparently, Tahrir had planned to just go and ask questions, and she did. Apparently, there were other people there who had the same agenda, and someone recorded part of the conversation about an hour into it, and we're not going to play the whole thing because it's about 11 minutes. We will link to the entire thing at majority.fm. We're just going to play the first couple of minutes of this because it is really fantastic. And genuinely impressive. These NSA recruiters, I don't think were anticipating actually having legitimate questions. They came in, presumably with their glossy pamphlets, promising a great career in the NSA. And what they ended up hearing was basically an indictment of what they do. But here is just the beginnings of this.
Yeah, I just had a question. You said that earlier that the two tasks that you do, one is sort of figuring out the tracking down the sort of communications of your adversaries, mm-hmm. and the other is protecting the communications of officials.
Right.
So do you consider Germany and the countries that the NSA has been spying on to be adversaries, or are you right now not speaking the truth? I mean, do you consider Germany, etc., an adversary, these European countries, or are you right now not telling us the truth and lying when you say that actually you simply track the, you know, you keep focusing on that, but clearly the NSA is doing a lot more than that, as we know. Well, so I'm just asking for a clarification.
What our foreign intelligence requirements are. So, you can define adversary as enemy, and clearly Germany is not our enemy, but would we have foreign national interest from an intelligence perspective on what's going on across the globe? Yeah, we do. I mean, that's our requirements that come to us as an intelligence community organization from the policymakers, from the military, from whoever, are global. So
adversaries, you actually mean anybody and everybody. There's nobody then by your definition that is not an adversary. Is that correct?
And it goes on. We will link to it. We can't play the whole thing, obviously, but and maybe what we'll do is for members, we'll drop it the entire 10-minute segment on the back end. For those of you not members, you got to come to the site, go track it down yourself. But the conversation goes on and obviously broadens out in many respects. And some of the students there said, how is it that you can – do you not ever contemplate the implications of what you're doing on people's lives? Or it's fascinating. And whether you agree or not as to whether or not we should be spying on every country in every instance, the really important aspect of this line of questioning that Tahir was following was the elasticity of the way things are defined. Because she's absolutely right. By saying our adversaries and then defining adversary is anybody else who exists in the world, because necessarily we live in, at least from their frame, a competitive world. So everything, every person, I would argue, and every country is an adversary, right? I mean, when I am protesting against the policies of the United States, am I not an adversary?
If you won't give our products preferential trade treatment.
If I won't give your product, our products preferential trade treatment. Are you not an adversary as a state? If you have resources that we want, are you not an adversary? Could you be headed to a country and trying to get their resources before we do? If you are building more refining capacity, if you are in any way impacting our GDP, I mean, the definition of adversary is anyone. And then we see the way that all of these definitions have been expanded, as we talked about yesterday, the definition of relevant, the definition of special needs, the definition of national security, the definition of terrorist, the definition of threat. All of these words are malleable in the hands of an apparatus that wants to expand its power. These people kept saying over and over again, we're just taking orders from the policymakers. Now, first off, the policymakers are formulating their orders based upon the advice that is given by these entities. And whether these entities are governmental entities or private entities. And so this is the self-licking ice cream cone. And this is why we must intervene in any way possible on this dynamic. It's not to say there should be no government. It's not to say there should be no national security. It's not to say there should be no corporations. It is simply that through a democratic process, we must intervene, because all of these entities, all institutions, in some regard, are always trying to strengthen themselves. When you're a hammer, everything is a nail. This is simply an inevitability of the human condition. They're trying to grow. They're trying to increase their power. And we must have short circuits in the process. And this is supposed to be, our system of government was supposed to be set up to do this. Congress was supposed to be a check on the executive. The judiciary was supposed to be a check on the Congress and the executive. The executive is supposed to have a check on the judiciary, and that they have the ability to appoint. And Congress is a check on the judiciary and the ability they have to impeach. I mean, on and on. But we have a failure and a breakdown in frankly, all of these branches of government. And I would extend that failure to the media and on, in some regard, to the citizenry at large. And this whole chain of circuit breaking, this whole change of accountability or chain of accountability, really in many respects, starts with the citizens. And must start with the citizens. When you have the systemic type of failure that we have, it must start with the citizens. And that's why to see what Sarah Slaman did, to see what Mahida Tahir did, is so important. And it's so important to project and amplify these voices. And we'll put both these up on YouTube. We're going to put all the links up on majority.fm. Please, if you don't do donate your account now and get these things automatically from us, if you haven't liked us on Facebook or on Twitter, then go to our YouTube page and spread these things around. These are important. These genuinely are important. Show it to your kids. I cannot wait. I'm not going to probably... Milo's not going to sit down and listen to the NSA one, but she is going to watch Sarah Slaman. And this is important. It really is important. We're going to take a break. We're going to head to the better half of the show. 646-257-3920 is the phone number. You can IM me at Majority FM. Folks, if you have the financial ability to become a member, please do. It is rare that we have people who regret their membership and cancel it. It happens, but it's pretty rare. It's far more common than people run out of money.
I don't think anyone's regretted their membership.
Well, I think sometimes people like join and then 3 months later say, you know what? Not my bag.
This is a real testament right here, folks, to the incredible integrity of Sam Seder. He is literally talking you out of a membership.
No, I'm saying, but we have the percent. It's like 0.01%.
Okay, good. The vast majority of people are usually satisfied.
Well, but then I would say 90% of our lost membership is a function of financial hardship. And so if you have the ability to pay... You listen to the show on a regular basis. Even if you don't want the extra content, it's going to help us maintain the show. We are, and I think I said this on the better half, but if you want to beta test the new Roku app that we have, send us an email and say, in the subject line, Roku Beta. And we're only accepting members now, incidentally, I should tell you, to beta test. Only members will have this option to beta test right now. If you're a member and you want to beta test the iPhone app, the iPad app, and I believe we're going to have an Android version too, then put into your subject line iPhone, iPad, or Android beta test. And we will get back to you within the next couple of weeks. You will be able to listen live through these apps. You will be able to access member feeds and non-member feeds. And if you have any suggestions as to what you would like to see in terms of features, also email us with that same headline. All right, folks, we're going to take a break. JustCoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. It's great coffee. 10% coupon code with the coupon code majority. And obviously, also, if you buy crap through Amazon, buy it through our link. It's at the homepage at majority.fm. Tomorrow on the program, Sarah Slayman will be joining us. It was fun to call. And, you know, you worry, you call, like, people you have to explain that we're legit. And she was a fan of Air America. So that was a rather easy booking.
She was like, of course I know who Sam Cedar is. That was actually the quote.
There you go. Bingo.
He's great as the editor of Huffington Post.
Yeah, he's really good on that.
I know
he's
that
really
guy.
He's Huffington
Alex
Post.
Wagner
he's really,
show all the time.
Yes,
I'd love
exactly.
to talk with him.
All right, folks. See you in the better half.